Just a reminder, the content of this show is for informational purposes only. Please visit blockstack.org/legal/disclaimers for more info. Hi there, and welcome to the Stacks Podcast. I'm Zach Valenti. This episode features a conversation between Peter Van Valkenburg, Director of Research at Coin Center, the leading nonprofit focused on the policy issues facing cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and Manib Ali, CEO of Blockstack PVC. Peter and Manib discuss Coin Center's mission and recent work, Facebook's Libra coin, the case for a true electronic cash, and more. And now, here's Peter and Manib.
Great having you here. I'm going to let you introduce yourself first. I think you'll do a better job.
Sure. So I'm Peter Van Valkenburg. I'm the Director of Research at Coin Center, which is a nonprofit research and advocacy organization focused on the public policy issues facing cryptocurrencies and open blockchain networks. And I've been doing that now for about almost 5 years now, which is crazy. It was sort of my first really big job out of law school. I'd worked at a couple of other advocacy groups and think tanks and things before this, but this was sort of like the first big job. And I couldn't ask for a better area to be focused on. I've had the opportunity to testify before Congress. I've had the opportunity to speak to regulators, primarily in the US, but all over the world, mostly on issues surrounding securities laws and cryptocurrencies, anti-money laundering laws and cryptocurrencies, consumer protection laws and cryptocurrencies. Not to make it sound like a laundry list, because it's always exciting because this technology challenges all kinds of preconceived notions about what regulations apply to or don't apply to, because these technologies allow people to do things that people have never been able to do before. And there's this open question, is that thing you're doing with the technology something that we would traditionally regulate, or is it really something brand new that we don't regulate? And then there's the question of whether we should regulate it or not. And so it can get complicated and fun really quickly. So if you're a lawyer and you want to work on some kind of new and exploding area with a lot of opportunity for growth and personal development, I don't think you can find a better spot. Yeah, for an entrepreneur, it might be frustrating that it's that it's that open for development. I don't know, but
yeah. No, definitely. I think our legal team here feels the same. They're like, these are some very interesting and challenging questions that they sometimes feel like, wow, this is like the cutting edge stuff that we are working on, right? And that makes them very, very excited to kind of like do that work. And I think like, you've been in the space for a while. Like, you're OG now. When was the first time you started sponsoring Coin Center? I think it was 2015, 16.
When did Blockstack sponsor Coin Center first?
Yeah, I think 2016 probably.
Yeah, you guys have been donors almost since the beginning as well. I guess Coin Center got its start in 2014. We got some really generous runway from a couple of donors who were just individuals, frankly, who wanted to see like a more adult advocacy organization in Washington, D.C. focused on this stuff. And so we had the benefit of being able to operate with really no strings attached for the first few years. And then by 2016, 2017, we've really just benefited from an amazing amount of generosity in the community. So we count amongst our supporters a lot of the major venture capital companies, a lot of the major exchanges, a lot of the major projects like Blockstack or Protocol Labs, and also still a lot of support from individuals. I think just until this year, and maybe even this year, I haven't looked at the numbers, half of our support still comes from sort of really generous individuals who want to support the freedom to innovate using cryptocurrencies and want somebody advocating for that in Washington, D.C. So it's pretty great.
Yeah, and I remember Jerry's email when he was asking about kind of like donations for next year. And he was like very honest and upfront. He's like, here's the work we have done. If you guys don't find it useful, please don't fund us anymore.
Yeah, we try and be pretty blunt about that, primarily because it's hard to explain to some people. I think you guys have already have always sort of understood it, but it's hard to explain to some people what Coin Center is supposed to be. Coin Center is supposed to be an independent sort of digital civil liberties organization that goes and represents the underlying open technologies to Congress or to regulators. We have no interest in or mission to represent any particular company and their use of the technology. We really just want to defend the open technology itself, because the open technology itself is this public good. It's this shared and unowned resource that hopefully will fundamentally change the way we architect the internet and international payments. And I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about that throughout this podcast, but I think that that's fundamentally important for human rights and human flourishing. And so it's fundamentally important that there be people in Washington, D.C. who are lawyers or trained as, you know, policy advocates who can explain that and the importance of these technologies to people in government so that they don't create bad policies that make it impossible to work on this stuff from unintended consequences or from ignorance.
Yeah, so this is how I explain CoinCenter to people. You can tell me if this makes sense. I simply say that they are people who actually understand this technology, and they understand the regulations and the law, which is a very rare combination. And they can be the right bridge between this technology and the various regulators or lawmakers.
I think that's right. A lot of what we do, I often think of as translation. We have an annual fundraising dinner. And a year ago, not this year's fundraising dinner, but the year before, I was giving a little speech about what we do. And I said, we take abstract technical concepts from the blockchain space and translate them into the language of government. And then that goes in one direction. And then the other direction, we take complicated legal structures and laws and regulations and translate them into plain language explainers about how the law works and explain them to government. Because more often than not, we're often explaining the law to lawyers in this space, not just to technologists, which is obviously part of what we do. But that's because I don't mean to sound cynical or sort of egocentric, like we're the only lawyers that know what the law is. It's not that. It's a situation where some of these laws haven't been reopened in decades, because they've been basically settled areas of law. And so you might have questions about the margins of the law, how they apply, you know, in minute different ways to new financial products, for example. But at the core, those new financial products didn't change anything fundamental, because they were always something issued by a person or a group of people as a trusted company or a regulated entity. Here comes blockchain and Bitcoin especially, and the other open, you know, consensus mechanism cryptocurrencies. They're not just new financial products. It's not like Goldman spun up some new asset-backed security, and you know, there's some new risks and there's some new benefits, but we don't know, you know. There's no Goldman in this context. There's a bunch of open source software developers who created a protocol that's run by computers around the world who are connected to the internet and keeping the blockchain and solving proof of work or proof of stake or whatever it is. And that somehow, as a cooperative action, manifests this new tool in the world that can be used for financial services, but there's no company. And all previous financial regulations, almost all of them, rely on finding a regulated entity, a company, and obligating that regulated entity to achieve the policy result that government wants, whether it's anti-money laundering, you know, you gotta know your customers and tell us about suspicious transactions, or securities law, you gotta know your investors and you gotta make sure that you disclose to them and register with us your disclosures so that everybody knows what your business is and whether you're likely to make money or not. But in a lot of situations here, you know, sometimes there is no obvious regulated entity to put those obligations on, because I don't know, in the Bitcoin case, for example, like, who's the issuer of the Bitcoin security? Who should file the disclosures? Is it Greg Maxwell? That makes no freaking sense. And it would be hilarious to see him try and comply, not to be mean to Greg Maxwell. And who in the Zcash space, to take just another example, should be obligated for anti-money laundering compliance. It's not going to be, you know, the Zcash Foundation or the Electronic Coin Company. That doesn't make any sense. They just write software. And so a lot of the complicated legal stuff that we've had to deal with, which is often new, not just to technologists, but also to lawyers in DC, has been, all right, in certain situations, there just won't be one of these regulated or obliged entities because there simply isn't. Like, I really honestly believe that there's no entity in the Bitcoin space that would fit into the category of issuer of Bitcoin as a security, and therefore should or would be able to disclose, you know, salient facts to investors about Bitcoin. So that means that Bitcoin isn't a security, and there is no one that needs to do securities compliance within Bitcoin. And then in other cases, like anti-money laundering law, maybe we can find some regulated entities, and this is something that's unfolded just over the last few years. Yeah, the custodial exchanges are obviously doing something very similar to what PayPal or Bank of America used to do. They're just holding people's bitcoins instead of their dollars. So it makes sense that they should know their customers and file suspicious activity reports, but certainly it doesn't make sense that any one individual using the protocol, software wallets and stuff, or the developers of the software themselves should be obligated to surveil their customers. So finding those intermediaries and figuring out how the old regulations that are always based on finding an intermediary apply is complicated and fun and hard and interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned kind of like Bitcoin in the context of securities regulations. One of my working theories is Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that person or group of individuals were, not only understood computer science, distributed systems, applied cryptography and game theory, they actually knew securities regulations as well. And that is why we don't know who is Satoshi Nakamoto.
Because they would have had to comply with securities law. I mean, I think it's a little too neat. Just disappear and then you won't have to comply with securities law. I think, and that shouldn't be the standard. Like, you shouldn't be forced to be an anonymous person when you're developing software in order to avoid compliance with a law that doesn't make sense in a particular context.
I was partly joking there, but interestingly, like not doing an issuance and just doing issuance through mining.
Yeah,
that there are strong arguments there for for how Bitcoin's token distribution was done.
Yeah, and I think from the policy objective that securities laws seek to address are correcting the asymmetric information between issuers who are promising things to investors and the investors who've paid money to the issuers. They've put risk capital forward, if you will, to use a term of art in this space. And you want to correct those asymmetries so that these people who are risking their money aren't doing it for stupid reasons or under a fraudulent assumption that they got from the issuer. And so if you're doing a pre-sale or maybe just any kind of sale from the centralized developer of the thing to the general public, you've got a lot of those potentials for information asymmetries. On the other hand, if all you do is just say, you know, here's the white paper, here's the running protocol, you know, it's just a bunch of poorly written C++ or whatever it is, go in peace, my fellow humans, and create Bitcoin or create whatever the cryptocurrency is. Like, Grin is kind of doing it even to this day without doing any kind of sale. They're just releasing software. In that case, there are still the potential for information asymmetries. And I've sort of gotten into this debate with Angela Walsh before about whether there's information asymmetries between software developers and the users of the software. Of course there are, but they're not the sort that securities laws are meant to address in that context, because sure, you're going to suffer some costs if you decide to become a Bitcoin miner after only looking at the white paper and the software. But it's very different than being an ordinary person with a bunch of cash who's decided to hand it over to somebody on their warranties or their promises that this will be a good investment. In that case, it's somebody who's probably technologically sophisticated in the Bitcoin mining case, who's got to figure out how to install open source software on their connected computer. Today, it would have to be a computer with an amazing amount of computing power. You're going to have to do a lot of research. You're not being promised anything except that you'll be able to mine. And if you successfully mine, you might make some money. It's kind of like reading about gold. And you're like, oh, well, there's gold in the earth. Cool. Someone has led me to think there's gold in the earth. That person's not issuing a security. You might then decide to take some risks based on that information. Like, oh, I'll buy some pickaxes and I don't know how you mine gold, you know, somehow like that. And then dig a big hole in the ground and then maybe you get some gold or you don't. That's kind of what mining and releasing a cryptocurrency through proof of work mining seems to be to me. And so in that case, it's not at all a security. It's really a commodity. There's still risks to buying it, selling it, mining it. But they're not the kind of risks that are asymmetries between an issuer and a purchaser, I think. Anyway.
Yeah, I think, and speaking of securities regulations, I should just make a note here that we have a public filing with the SEC. And because of that, there are certain things that I cannot discuss or I can't comment on. And I have to be very careful. And usually, like any material that we put up, we have a Rule 235 disclaimer there saying that this can be considered testing the waters.
Yes. I mean, am I allowed to say stuff, Muneeb, about you?
You are allowed to say whatever. Whatever CoinList allows you to say. And my understanding is it's a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just from my perspective as someone who's watched you guys build what you're building and try and fit into the rules, I think you've taken a really responsible and conservative approach to securities law compliance. You know, there's all kinds of projects out there. I won't name any of them specifically who just decided to like write a white paper, expect 2 or 3 or 4 years of software development up in the future. But, before that happens, just decide, oh, hell, we'll advertise it and we'll sell to the general public and we'll raise literally billions of dollars. What? In exchange for just a promise of some token that's not going to exist for another few years. That, if you don't comply with securities laws, is like painting a target on your back. And I think almost, you know, rightfully so. I'm not a huge fan of the way we do investor protection in this country because it's very permissioned and it also excludes a lot of investors from participating, especially in early risky ventures because of the accredited investor rule. But at the same time, I mean, if you're really just like collecting $1 billion from mom and pop investors on just a hope and a prayer that you actually build the protocol you've described, maybe you should be regulated. And so that's not what you guys did, which is great. Although at the same time, because you wanted to be compliant, you've had to, I think, take a slower path. You've had to, you have to wait. It's a permission-based regulation. You have to submit some things to the SEC, like you said, and now you can't even talk about them now because they're still pending. Because the SEC is going to come back and hopefully say, we don't know, hopefully say, yeah, all the paperwork looks in order. You're ready to do your offering the way you've described it, fitting into the securities law. So I don't know too many projects that have been as careful as you guys. In fact, I don't think any project has been as careful as you guys. Now, whether that'll work out for you or for your investors or for the protocol itself, I don't know, but I applaud you for doing what is really a lot of hard work.
No, thank you for that. And I think we should actually try to do another podcast when, fingers crossed, like all of this is over and done. And we can look back and then discuss like various aspects of it. Without having like too many concerns around. But
that's cool. My calendar 5 years from now is open. So it's a bad joke.
Yeah. Hopefully, it's going to be going to not take that long. We're confident. Cool. So one thing I was just thinking about as we were starting this podcast is we actually had you host our BlockStack Summit in Berlin, and you interviewed Edward Snowden there. How was that experience? And you know, has he been more active in the space, or that was like a one-off thing where he kind of like interacted a little bit? But I think he mentioned Zcash. He seemed like he was familiar with what those projects are doing.
So that experience was awesome. It's still probably one of the craziest things I've ever done. It was funny. We have an awesome guy on our team. Well, he's technically the outside counsel at CoinCenter, and we always kind of like make fun of him for being outside. He doesn't like that. And so he's a lobbyist. And when he found out that I was interviewing Snowden, he found out like after I interviewed Snowden, and he said something like along the lines of, "And you didn't think to freaking tell me? You didn't think to say, hey, I'm interviewing somebody who a lot of people in Congress think is a traitor to America weeks before I'm going to testify before Congress?" Because I testified in front of House Financial Services only like 2 weeks after I interviewed Snowden. And he was like, "Do you know what you're going to do if, you know, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee looks you in the eye and says, 'Mr. Van Valkenburg, thank you for coming and testifying in front of Congress, but please do tell us why you've been consorting with treasonous persons.'" And I was like, Alex, his name's Alex, he's a great guy, and I'm sure he'll be watching this, and I hope he's okay with me telling the story. I was like, "Alex, I think that's like a complicated subject. Some people think he's a hero. Some people think he's a traitor. Even within the US government, that's true. And all I'm going to do is just talk to him about cryptocurrency and cybersecurity and like the way the internet works. And because that's what you guys wanted me to do. And that's why I agreed to do it, because that's what I would want to do. You know, regardless of how you feel about this guy, even if you think he really did do grave harm to, you know, American interests abroad or the intelligence community, even if you think that, it would be naive for you to deny that this is a person in the world who can speak and will speak and who has a lot of interesting insight into what's wrong with the internet today, how is it broken, how are systems for keeping secrets broken today, mostly because they're centralized and vulnerable to attack, even if he's the attacker in some cases. And are there reasons to be optimistic about this technology for solving some of those vulnerabilities and those problems with the way we've architected the internet today? And he was pretty sanguine about it. Like, he wasn't super, super bullish, because I think he's smart and he knows that all systems are vulnerable, and it would be foolish to say that this is a panacea, as a lot of people unfortunately do say about blockchain. But at the same time, he had some interesting things that he was excited about. You mentioned Zcash as one of the things. What has he done since? I don't know. I haven't kept up with him. And that's not just me trying to keep the NSA off my back. I just actually have not kept up with him. Believe me. I do think he's been like quasi-active in the Zcash development community to a certain extent. I'm not sure about this, but I think he participated in the sort of redux of the trusted ceremony. So there was a trusted ceremony a while ago to create the ZK-SNARK parameters.
You participated in?
I did participate in that, yeah. Much to my wife's chagrin, because I set up a time-lapse camera in the bedroom, and so she slept on the couch in the living room for the whole weekend and was like, what is any of this? Why do you have a computer in the other room that's not connected to anything but the power outlet, and you're like worshiping it like it's a temple? Why? She's great. I'm very lucky. Anyway, that ceremony was small. There was like, I was one of six participants to generate the parameters, and you had to only believe that one of us out of the six was uncompromised in order to believe that the parameters were authentically random and therefore could be used in good faith to create the transaction shielding that Zcash uses to enhance privacy on that network. There was a desire, of course, to increase the security assumptions inherent in that trusted setup. And so with the release of Sapling, a newer version of Zcash, they wanted to redo with the ceremony to generate the random parameters, and did it in a way that it didn't have to happen sequentially with everyone sort of talking to each other over the internet in order to see who's going to make their computer generate random numbers next. It could be done asynchronously with, you know, people just periodically adding their randomness to a blob that was sitting on a GitHub repository. And so I think we had a whole bunch of people contribute randomness to that. I didn't, because I was busy. It was right around the time I was testifying in Senate banking, I think. But I think, I'm not sure, I think Snowden was one of several people who contributed randomness to that blob. Other than that, he's worked on something really cool with the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which is if you have an old cell phone and you want to turn it into like a little alarm system to know if I don't know exactly how it works. You use an old cell phone, you install the software that Snowden developed on it, and then somehow it helps you know if there's like presence in the room or something like that. So you could put it in a room where you have a computer you want not to be, you know, messed with, and the phone is sort of like a watchdog for the computer. I think it's something like that. I shouldn't talk about things I don't understand, but I heard he developed that. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if he takes a bigger hand in this tech. I'm not sure I want him to, because as I said, politically, he's sort of like a hot potato, or I don't know what the right metaphor is. Like he's not good optics.
Yeah, we experienced a similar thing. Like I think when I was updating some of our investors, and I was so excited that Edward Snowden is a keynote speaker there. Right. Part of me was like, this investor might be excited. This may not be that excited. So I was like trying to handle it on a case by case basis.
Right.
It was very interesting when he was kind of like playing around with some early applications built on Blockstack. I know that Patrick was actually chatting with Snowden on an app built on Blockstack. That was pretty cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. Speaking of apps, like have you checked out any of the latest stuff that's being built on Blockstack?
So I have a real interest in Graphite, which is the Google Docs type app, right?
Yep.
But I'm ashamed to say we've never, like we keep meaning to start using it or testing it out. And then at Coin Center, we always kind of like get distracted by something else. Primarily because it's amazing how many things I've written on Google Docs and they're all just sitting there, and I've kind of come to trust that Google is going to be a good steward of my information. They're not going to lose all of these reports and internal memos that we've written, nor will they leak something that is supposed to be an internal memo rather than a public facing thing. Although most of our advocacy materials are public. And so we'd been looking for a long time for some sort of non-Google, as you say, Muneeb, very, very well can't be evil alternative to Google Docs. But, and I hear Graphite is great, but you're making me feel bad. We should dedicate a day to seeing if we can make it work with our
workflow. You should, because I think especially in the last 6 months, the quality of applications has gone up a lot. Basically a sign of the developer platform getting more mature. And I think in the last 6 months, we've had some like 140 new applications.
That's awesome.
All the way from alternatives to kind of like photo sharing sites, professional networking sites. Even a small tool just today came out where it seems like a bookmarking tool, but it's completely private. So whatever you're reading online, no third person knows. And it's like, because developers are able to build these things quickly, and it's a generic framework for decentralized apps, we're seeing a bunch of activity. I'll send you some links to some of the apps that I'm using more frequently.
Yeah, I'd be curious about the bookmarking tool. I remember like back when like Delicious was a thing, and I actually used it a lot, and then eventually they killed it, and I was like, damn it. What?
Yeah, there's an email service as well, which is it doesn't use SMTP. So it's a fully kind of like encrypted email. It's called Dmail. So we have this app mining mechanism where every month we have a process for ranking kind of like the top applications. And I believe Dmail was number one last month.
Ooh.
And so it's like, imagine that all of your messages are fully encrypted only with you. And it's an email interface on top of that.
Interesting. Does it work? Can you send mail to someone who's not using it though?
Using it? So right now it's basically like you would send me email on Muneeb.id, or you would send email to Fred Wilson on Fred.id.
Yeah.
I think he was playing around with it, and a bunch of people started emailing him.
It's so hard. Like I really hope you guys or somebody, like I know a lot of people are building similar things on Ethereum, but no matter what, like I hope you guys can do it, because network effects are a bitch, to put it in a somewhat grotesque way. It's just like, if you're talking about a communication system or a system where people pay each other, the ones that have succeeded are not the ones that were the best architected. In fact, they're all pretty garbage. Like SMTP is a great protocol for the fact that it's an open protocol, at least. But layering privacy on top of SMTP is hard. I mean, just look at all the attempts and failures at doing encrypted email, like PGP and things like that. And so it succeeded because you want to use the service that everyone else uses, because it's very frustrating if you, like, say, want to email Neil Stevenson and he uses a different service, you know? So you're just going to default to the one that everyone's on, even if it's not great for privacy, or even worse, like if it's like, well, everyone's on Facebook, so let's just use Facebook Messenger now instead of email. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Did Neil Stevenson just randomly come to your mind? Because he's coming. No,
we've got the show notes for the podcast right here on the left.
And yeah, yeah.
Neil Stevenson does often randomly come to my mind. I'm actually on the 9th book in the Baroque cycle right now, which is, I think, the first or the second one of volume 3, which the Baroque cycle, for anyone who has maybe read a couple Neil Stevenson books and has been afraid to start the Baroque cycle, read it. It's awesome. It's historical fiction, but basically still sci-fi, because he, like, invents characters that were, like, that could have conceivably been friends of Leibniz and Newton back in the days of the early Enlightenment, and so, like, creates an alternative history where, like, maybe one of them sort of invents digital computing, you know, centuries before we actually invented digital computing, which is interesting because it's actually believable, as crazy as that sounds. But, like, a lot of people know Leibniz for inventing the calculus, or co-inventing it, or simultaneously inventing it with Newton. Leibniz was also the first to describe to the West binary arithmetic, because he decoded or figured out a message from somebody in China at the time where binary arithmetic was actually invented. And he was obsessed with the cataloging of information and the possibility of building arithmetic engines, which was a very primitive way of basically saying he wanted to build computers, but he never did build anything that was really a functioning prototype, but came close. And how different would it have been if, you know, back in the days of the Enlightenment, we started actually building computers? Anyway, mechanical computers.
Yeah, yeah, that's super interesting. So, to give you an idea on how much I like his writing, my PhD thesis, which is like a decade of work for me, the first chapter starts with a code from Snowcrash.
Nice.
So nice. We're super excited to have him at the 2019 summit in San Francisco. I think Naval Ravikant is going to basically have a fireside chat.
I'm super jealous. It's cool because I got to interview Snowden at the last Blockstack conference, but I've always wanted to talk to Neil Stevenson about cryptocurrency. And, you know, it's funny. I was talking with a guy, his name's Eran Tromer. He's one of the founding scientists of Zcash. And Eran went to a book signing that Neil was having in New York City recently, because he's got his new book out, which I haven't picked up yet. The Baroque Cycle's long. and Eran asked Neil, like, which book do you think most describes a payment method in a future hypothetical world that is like Zcash, you know, one that's encrypted and private? And he says, well, I don't know, maybe Snowcrash. And I was like, what? No, it's the Diamond Age. The Diamond Age describes Zcash. And Eran was like, maybe he doesn't remember his own books as well as you do. I was like, well, that's fair. He's written a lot of books since the Diamond Age. But the great thing about the Diamond Age, which is this whole story about a somewhat dystopian, you know, post-nation state future, where there's this whole plot about this woman who is the voice actor for a book that pays for voice acting services, because the book is meant to be a book for children that bonds to one child and creates an educational experience that grows with them from very, very young to adolescence. The book is smart and sort of reconfigures its lessons and its thinking through some sort of artificial intelligence. But the one thing they couldn't make work well, you know, in the story, was like realistic human synthesized speech. So the book just contracts out anonymously to voice actors to read to the child. And there's this woman who is the voice actor in the Diamond Age who is getting these payments to act, to do voice acting for this book, and realizes that it's all coming from one book for one child, and realizes that she's actually becoming like a mother to this child who seemingly spends way too much time with the book, as in maybe she's an orphan or homeless or God knows what. And so she develops this very fierce maternalistic attachment to this girl that she knows she's educating through her voice acting. And she really wants to find the child. The problem, and sort of the central like drama creating conceit of the book, is that all payments in this future are made through an encrypted payment network that's rather like Zcash, where it's impossible to trace back where the payment came from. She's just been getting these anonymous payments to do her voice acting. And then eventually there's this whole complicated story about how she does end up tracking the payments and finding Nell, the child. But I'm like, that's Zcash, not Snow Crash. I mean, Snow Crash has got like obviously some sort of censorship resistant money in it, which is part of the reason why that world's so crazy. But the Diamond Age is all about Zcash, I think. Anyway.
Yeah. I think he has written enough books now. And plus, I think his fans would know details more than him at this point. Yeah, coming back to this idea of kind of like decentralized applications, one model that I have in my mind is it's a little bit like when Linux was starting, right? So you had these big companies like Microsoft, which is like a centralized player, but developers are kind of like getting together to build an open alternative. And initially, the applications built on top, they would be a lot more clunky, and only kind of like diehard fans would go through the trouble of actually using them. And I think it's definitely easier for apps that are single player, because you're just directly getting utility out of it. Then it's a little bit harder if you need to interact with just a few people. Like I think one example would be this DocuSign alternative. So it's a more secure way of like signing docs, but you're not keeping your sensitive documents with a company. And plus, the signatures are actual cryptographic signatures, not just like, hey, I'm typing a name in a box, and that's my signature. There's actual association with private keys. And over there, I think that's still been the next step, because now you just need to convince one person to use that app.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the Linux comparison is apt. Like a use case like that is more of an enterprise use case. And where Linux really first became a massive success was not on the desktop. Like people always say, like 2019 will finally be the year of Linux on the desktop. And unfortunately, I'm running Windows 10 right now, I'm ashamed to say, on this setup. Although I've got a home server right over here, a little box that I have all my smart home stuff built on top of. Using Home Assistant, which is an open source smart home setup. You guys should like integrate with them for some Blockstack stuff. I don't know. Could be useful. Anyway, so I'm using it a little bit, but I'm weird, you know, like, and that thing is a pain in the ass. And for this, like just steady podcasting, Ubuntu probably would work, but I'm using Windows 10. But Linux really succeeded on web servers, you know, like all of these centralized services we're talking about that maybe one day, you know, people like Blockstack or Ethereum will replace, they're all running Apache servers and they're all running, you know, Linux. So
yeah, absolutely.
Enterprise use case where stuff just has to work, but it doesn't have to look shiny and user friendly because it's going to be some sysadmin that sets it up who's super, you know, focused on like the task at hand and doesn't need the bells and whistles. That makes sense. So like, yeah, maybe decentralized apps, will have their best success early on in those sort of niche enterprise, highly technical persons use cases. But the thing about document signatures is it's not highly technical people that really do a lot of that. It's like lawyers who are some of the least technical people on the face of the planet, which is why, as you said, like signatures for a long time on like binding court documents have just been like crappy bitmaps of somebody's and not cryptographically secure, not private public private key based, which is crazy because we've had public private keys since, you know, the 70s, and maybe it would have been cool to use those, but the legal profession takes a long time to adopt new technology. In fact, like I'm of a generation of lawyers who went to law school and had to learn how to type fast because exams were finally done on computers and it was like a brain dump. It was like type as much as you can in order to get an A. If you don't type fast, you will not get an A even if you're brilliant. But the generation before me, they saw typing as something that you hire a secretary to do, which is ridiculous and insane. There was like this prejudice against any kind of like technical arts versus the high-minded academic or professional law like thing. So, you know, good luck getting a bunch of lawyers even to this day to group edit a Google Doc, let alone use Graphite.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we knew that Linux won the servers war when even Microsoft started using Linux in their data centers.
Yeah. I mean, they've just done a total 180, probably because they saw the writing on the wall as far as, you know, their consumer software business. And thank God for that, because otherwise they'd be gone, I guess, by now. But they're doing super well on the cloud and even on some of the blockchain stuff. Like, it's cool to see them building some really good identity tools and things like that.
What do you think of Facebook Libra?
I have a lot of thoughts about Facebook Libra. I should be careful about what I say because I don't want to be unfair. I guess there's some few things. I'm trying to prioritize in my head what I want to talk about now. You know, it's a really complicated system they're building that's still nonetheless permissioned, you know? It's a permissioned blockchain. And the rhetoric they use oftentimes when they describe what they're building and the regulatory consequences is the rhetoric of the permissionless blockchain communities. Where you say, well, it's not a company issuing a cryptocurrency. It's an association of people around the world. And so maybe treatment is a little different because of that, but it's a permissioned association. The consensus mechanism is, it's hot stuff. It's a Byzantine fault tolerant, you know, algorithm that's been around for a long time, effectively in some form or another. And the only people who can participate in the consensus are whitelisted participants. Who will, I presume, identify themselves through key signatures that have been distributed in advance. So you can't, it's not an open blockchain. It's not a blockchain where anyone can add transactions to the ledger and independently verify the transactions. It's, you got to trust these whitelisted participants. And so my thinking there from a regulatory standpoint is you've got a whole bunch of whitelisted participants. They all have, you know, power on the network to block transactions if they work in concert with each other. And they have the power in the association, this Libra association that's been described, to re-architect the protocol how they see fit. Like, they're the ones who are entrusted to update the software and decide how to build the software. So if you've got regulations to comply with, this is what I was saying earlier, with Bitcoin, there's a lot of regulations that don't apply because it would be nonsensical to apply them because there isn't a centralized intermediary who you could trust to achieve the policy result or expect to achieve the policy result you want. Well, with Libra, that's not true at all. There are identified parties who you could trust to achieve the policy result you want. So I'm sorry I've been speaking slightly in the abstract thus far, but to make it concrete, let's just take one area of policy, and most of the areas of policy we've looked at will be potentially troublesome to Libra. But one big one is just US sanctions law. You are not allowed, even if you're an individual, you're not allowed to transact or interact economically with someone on the SDN list, which is this list of persons and persons in countries where you just shouldn't be sending your money. Like, everyone in Iran, for example, if you're an American, you should not be transacting with. And that's just the law. You can debate the wisdom of that law or not as a policy tool, but that's just the law. Europe is not as happy with our sanctions against Iran. Like, countries in Europe think that maybe this is the wrong approach to opening up Iran and having good diplomacy and you know, diffusing a tense situation in the Middle East. So European nations are finding ways to route around U.S. sanctions. The Libra Association is going to be this group of identified persons, which are really just corporations, including, you know, Facebook, but also including like Visa and MasterCard. Whose laws are they going to comply with respect to sanctions? Are they going to comply with U.S. sanctions laws? I would think they would have to, even if some of their members in the association might be European and might not want to comply with U.S. sanctions laws. And so, I don't know. I mean, do they expect that they just will comply with U.S. sanctions laws? Maybe. And that changes fundamentally what the thing is. It's not censorship-resistant cash. It's not really a cryptocurrency. It's just another payment rail, which if it's just another payment rail, why build it in such a complicated way? Why not just make it like PayPal instead of this weird permissioned cryptocurrency hybrid? I don't know. That's one thought. Another thought is the whole reserve thing. So aside from being permissioned, unlike Bitcoin being permissionless, Libra is going to be asset-backed, and some sort of trusted entity is going to have to hold the assets or be capable of issuing and redeeming Libra in relation to assets that are held in order to keep the value of Libra stable. Bitcoin, of course, is not something very stable in value, and that's because there is no person holding assets that back up Bitcoin. Bitcoin's just economically scarce, and so, you know, supply and demand, if supply is fixed and demand shifts to the right, the price goes up. But if demand shifts to the left, the price goes down. So it's just a much simpler economic calculus. Whereas over here, you've got this reserve function, and the creation or destruction of Libra to keep the price steady is based on assets in a reserve. If you are a company that has assets in a reserve and people are trading effectively a pro rata share of the value of those assets, that sounds like a security to me. I mean, especially if some of those assets are themselves securities, and they've said that some of the assets in the Libra reserve will be, treasuries and other low risk things like that. So you've bundled up a bunch of securities and other assets and securitized them, i.e. made shares of them, and people trade them on this network that is actually permissioned, so you could actually decide who is and is not allowed to trade them. And yet I don't think there's plans to register Libra as a security, because frankly, if you did, it would be very useless as a currency because it would only be allowed to be traded on securities exchanges and there'd be all sorts of other compliance obligations. So there's just like so many things from a legal standpoint that I still don't understand what their legal strategy is. And I'm having trouble being creative enough to figure out how they're going to navigate it. Now, maybe I'm just not a good lawyer or not a great lawyer and just can't see what their lawyers are seeing because they haven't come out and said exactly how they're going to comply with all these things. But I'd be very surprised if they find solutions to some of these problems that we haven't thought of yet. And if they can't find solutions, then it's not going to work the way it's currently specified. It's going to be regulated into the ground. And then the last thing I'll say, I have never seen such a rapid and aggressive response from members of Congress to the launch of a new tech project.
That was super, super surprising.
It was crazy. On the day that the Libra thing went public and the white paper was released and all that, Maxine Waters, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, which is the committee that oversees the SEC and could, you know, say, hey, SEC, what are you doing about Libra? Maxine Waters comes out and says, you must stop, Facebook, stop developing this right now and do not start developing it again until you come and testify before us. That's like, that doesn't happen. That's something new. And gosh knows that Facebook has not been the favorite on Capitol Hill since the Cambridge Analytica stuff and, you know, questions of impropriety with data. So I see regulatory hurdles, which are more nuts and bolts of the law, and political hurdles, which is, you know, the people who will oversee the regulators in Congress don't seem happy. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm super skeptical.
Do you think the reaction from Washington is linked with some of the antitrust stuff that's going on as well?
I think absolutely. I mean, like, you've got this climate where people like Elizabeth Warren, you know, rightly or wrongly, I don't know, are saying maybe we need to break up all the tech companies. And then Facebook comes along and, you know, I almost think there was an attempt at Facebook maybe to say like, no, we're doing this one differently. It's going to be a blockchain and it's going to be decentralized. So it's us actually giving up power, which I question because it's actually a centralized blockchain. It's a permissioned network. But so maybe they thought like, oh, this is us proving that like we're investing in being less powerful, kind of like how they talk about WhatsApp a lot now, which is end-to-end encrypted and owned by Facebook. So they can't really use the data that they would maybe want to use in the WhatsApp client. And so maybe this is kind of like that. But at the same time, that's not how necessarily your average member of Congress is going to perceive this. They're not going to say, oh, Facebook's making money now, you know, like actually issuing money, but it's okay because it's a blockchain. People in Congress are either not well educated enough about blockchain technology to know why maybe that's a credible thing to say, or they're so well educated, the ones that actually have learned about this stuff, that they'll to some extent see through that if they look at the white paper and realize that it's a permission system. And so really, people in Congress, whether they're on the sort of low end of the spectrum with regard to knowing about cryptocurrency technology, or on the high end, are going to say, this is Facebook, who we're already talking, some of us are talking about like antitrust issues and becoming too big, and now they want to replace the world's currency? Like become the global reserve currency for all payments everywhere with their billions of users on their app? I've probably said way too much already about Facebook. I will say something nice in that if any company is going to build a payments tool, they should build cryptocurrencies. I'm just disappointed that they didn't basically fork Bitcoin or integrate Bitcoin. You could just integrate Bitcoin into WhatsApp. And there's scaling issues there and there's price stability issues there. And I think the charitable way to talk about what happened with the technical architecture of Libra is maybe they started with that, but then in order to get scalability and price stability, they had to build a permission system.
That's what they say in the white paper, right?
Right.
That we are giving ourselves 5 years to figure out how to build the open system.
Right.
But in the meanwhile, because of scalability, the only way to scale this to a billion users is to have a closed system.
Yeah. And I guess my feeling about that is, well, then don't build it yet. You know, fix those problems. Do that really groundbreaking work to make a permissionless system that's scalable. And then you've made a real contribution to the space. And people won't care if you're Facebook or not. They'll just be like, that's cool tech. Now, that said, I've heard a lot of people who say that Move, the smart contracting language that they've architected, which is an alternative, if you will, to like Ethereum's Solidity or what have you, is apparently extremely elegant. So there's obviously some real work going on here. I'm not smart enough to be able to make that claim, but people I trust have made that claim.
Yeah, so Move is, the motivation for Move is very similar to the smart contract language that we launched yesterday, Clag.
Oh.
Yeah, so I was pretty sure you haven't seen this yet. So it's very, I think the motivations are the same. They want more predictability in the smart contracts, in the sense that you should be able to analyze them before running them. So you
right.
know exactly what the contract can and cannot do. But the way they ended up making certain design decisions are very different from us. So it's mm-hmm. still a Turing complete language, which actually limits the kind of proofs you can have before actually running the contract. And then mm-hmm. there are certain other things in which Clarity is different. And obviously I'm biased, but we think our approach is superior.
No, that's cool. It's called, what is it called? Clarity?
Yeah, Clarity.
Clarity. Now, what is that from? Oh, Clarity is the weird drug that everyone's addicted to in Minority Report, I think, right?
No, for us.
I'm sure that's not what you were naming it after.
For us, it was like you have clarity into what this contract is going to do, right?
No, that makes sense. And gosh knows that I've said gosh knows twice now, and yet I also like cursed earlier. I don't know what's going on with my vocabulary. God knows that Solidity has had this particular issue where it's hard to know exactly what you just wrote in a smart contract until you launch it on mainnet and then somebody breaks it in like the DAO hack example. So, you guys are probably building the right thing then.
Yeah, the way we're thinking about this is you really want to give developers the right precise tools so that they don't end up harming themselves. Like these developers are trying to write Solidity contracts. They're not doing it on purpose, right? It's like they're working with a tool that is kind of like wild, right? And it's hard to control. And they end up hurting themselves. And that was something that we explicitly wanted to avoid in the design of the language itself, because you end up, everyone ends up benefiting if the underlying foundation is actually done in a more thoughtful way.
Tezos makes this claim too. Do you guys?
Yeah, so I think recently the new languages that are coming up, they're much better. It's just that Ethereum is very interesting, right? Like they have a large community, and Ethereum kind of like started everyone in the industry in a certain direction from a technology perspective.
Right.
And I believe that most of those things were wrong, right? And at some point, like our industry would have to like self-correct that, hey, this was a bad decision, this was a bad decision, this was a bad decision. But one thing that they have done is that it's like kind of like embracing experimentation and all sorts of like weird ideas or half-baked things. Like, why don't we just like go ahead and do it? And even if we discover that yes, this is a bad idea, like 2 years down the road, they're building that interesting experimentation mentality, right? Versus saying that let's get all the experts in the room and do a deep dive and figure out what's a kind of like a responsible way of doing this. It's you could argue that that having lots of experimentation could also lead to good results.
I mean, it also seems to be benefiting them in the sense of network effects. Like, it's true that they're one of the earliest like decentralized the web projects out there. So maybe the network effects are just age based, but it could also just be this willingness to push stuff out there maybe before it's fully manicured or even fully compliant with the law, maybe, in which case it draws an interesting parallel with you guys. and then you just rely on the fact that if you're first to market, you're going to gain a huge community of developers to build on top of it. And I will say, you know, in credit to the Ethereum folks, it's one of the most vibrant crypto communities I ever have encountered. Like, you go, especially in Europe, you go to Berlin, for example, and there's just like huge Ethereum meetups and all sorts of people building on top of this stuff. They've been a really inclusive community, which is good too. I know I keep talking about Zcash, and so I should disclose that I'm a member of the Zcash Foundation's board of directors. And I did say earlier about how I was, as an individual, participating in the first parameter generation ceremony. I'll also say that I am an uncompensated board member of the foundation because people have accused me of like bias, and I actually have a fairly de minimis amount of Zcash. I actually have fairly little cryptocurrency in general because I decided to buy a house and that's where all my capital is. Anyway, so we had ZCon, which is the annual conference that the Zcash Foundation puts on in Croatia. Just last week, I flew back the day before yesterday, so I might be a little jet lagged right now still. And there were Ethereum people there, which was great. It was like, and we didn't even like make a strong effort to get them there. They seemed to just go to other people's conferences, and it's not as tribal as like you know, Bitcoin people tend to be, unfortunately, very focused on their own tech and extraordinarily suspicious of other projects, which is sometimes right because God knows there's a lot of scams out there. But that can lead to a sort of insular worldview. And the one thing I'll say about Ethereum, you know, tech aside and the way the protocol is built aside, it's a big friendly community actually that usually does a lot to bring people in rather than scare them away, which is something I think all of the cryptocurrency communities should probably learn from.
No, absolutely. I think their community is is very friendly, especially because they get compared to Bitcoin, which is a very low bar. And compared to them, they definitely come across as really friendly. And it's interesting that you brought up our approach with the regulators as well. Like if you look at like what we are doing with the regulators, if you look at what we are doing at the tech level, like all sorts of things like blockchain level, smart contract language design. I swear we're not doing this on purpose, but every decision we make ends up being the exact opposite of Ethereum. Like exact opposite. So it's a very, I think, in a way it's good for the industry that these different paths are being explored in parallel.
Yeah. I mean, gosh knows there were, I said gosh knows again, this is like new in my vocabulary. It's just there now. I just need to accept it.
It's the jet lag.
There were all kinds of approaches to building the internet in the early days. Like, you know, X25 was an alternative packet switching network. In some ways better, in some ways worse. Xanadu was a thing. I don't know a lot about Xanadu other than the fact that it was architected from the ground up to be a better web and might have actually been a much better web. And technology stack below the web, you know, with a better way of moving packets around and a better way of attributing sort of ownership and identity to content and all kinds of things that were crazy, but it was crazy complicated and impossible to architect and maybe just too ambitious. And so that's one criticism for Ethereum is that it's like the Xanadu of blockchain projects. And yet maybe this time Xanadu wins. I mean, who knows? So cool to be in this space at this point where anything could still happen.
Yeah, and there was this thing called active networks, which actually reminds me of Ethereum a lot because what they were trying to do was instead of the traditional internet architecture, which is end-to-end, meaning that the core of the network is very simple,
right,
and the complexity is at the edges, active networks were trying to make the network more complicated and more intelligent. Right. So there were things like, what if your router could also do this and that instead of just like sending packets from here to there, right? And that starts reminding me of like DAOs and the idea of just run your program at the blockchain and let's have all this intelligence in the network itself. And those ideas have been tried before. Obviously, it's not the same application. It's not like early 90s anymore.
Different constraints, different opportunities.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So we would speaking of our summit, I think we'd love to get you involved in the summit this time as well. I'll follow up separately about it.
Maybe I'll slip something in Naval's drink so that you need a backup moderator, you know? So I can meet Neil finally.
So Naval, if you're listening, watch out for Peter at the event.
Now, Naval's an awesome person. Actually, interview Neil though, like total like lateral thinker, and he's just so fun to follow on Twitter. Sometimes I make fun of him on Twitter, but my life would be much poorer if Naval was not on Twitter giving me wisdom.
No, he's awesome, and he's also like one of the really early backers of. Stack as well. I think he was pretty much the first money in, even before.
He was for our first year. He was on the board of directors of the Zcash Foundation. Actually, he just ended up being like overworked, too many things that he was doing at the same time. But that was a real boon, though, because the Zcash Foundation needs perspectives on how to, you know, drive development of the Zcash protocol and, you know, privacy protecting cryptocurrencies and private financial transactions. And so we wanted somebody from like the academic community, from the legal community, like me. We had Matt Green and Andrew Miller from the technical community. And then Naval was like really helpful to have because he's got a great business mind and sort of more of a investor business perspective. So, yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. He's great. So what's the biggest project you're spending your time on these days? Like what's the most interesting thing that pulls you in?
So Coin Center pivoted a little bit around like 15 months ago or so, because the securities work that we'd done a lot of work on and gotten some good results from, basically like educating the SEC about the technology, creating a framework for figuring out how we can figure out when a cryptocurrency is or is not a security, things like that. That had all sort of wrapped up in the sense that we thought that the SEC reached a good spot, generally speaking, where the rules were clear enough. Bitcoin and Ethereum, as they trade today, not securities. We heard that from regulators. And a sort of roadmap to, if you want to build something like Bitcoin or Ethereum, here's how you get there. And you guys are now actually like really testing that roadmap. So, you know, so maybe if it doesn't work out for you, we'll have to go and back and do more work on securities law, because I think if it should work out for anyone, it should work out for you. So I hope it does. But so we thought like, okay, well that area of law is fairly settled. We started working on that way before most people were talking about securities law. So we were like, okay, can you hear a siren outside?
Yeah. It's okay.
I live in DC. Now the ambulance has decided to park itself right there. Okay, now it's gone. Anyway, so we were faced at around a year and a half ago with this question. Okay, what's going to be a big issue in a year or 2 years? What do we need to start laying the groundwork on from a policy perspective now in order to have good policy outcomes later? And the topic that we kept coming back to, Jerry, our executive director, and myself, when we would just, you know, think about these things, because we're independent, we can drive our own mission how we see fit to defend the freedom to innovate, was privacy and electronic cash, as in censorship resistant and actually private digital currency. Bitcoin is censorship resistant, but unless you're using a lot of stuff on top, like maybe Wasabi Wallet and Tor and other things, it's not very private at all. The blockchain is very transparent. You see all the transactions on it. You see the graph of who paid who. You can very easily identify those pseudonyms on the blockchain. And then you have really, it's like a dream tool for a totalitarian state to have a fully public and auditable record that can't be forged or faked of all the people in your country and who they've paid. Like that's a gift to a single party state like China. So Bitcoin, I think, ultimately needs to either change and be more private. And, you know, a lot of the privacy coins that we now see were originally proposed as amendments to the Bitcoin protocol, like the Zero Coin paper, which is what Zcash was eventually built from, was proposed as a way to modify Bitcoin. And the Bitcoin developers, I don't mean to make them sound like they resisted something that was an obvious thing to do. They didn't incorporate it because it was too high risk. Not regulatory risk. I think people misunderstand and think that there's like a lot of pressure from regulators to not build these things. There aren't those sorts of pressures, at least not yet. But high risk from a technology standpoint, like zero knowledge proofs are moon math cryptography, much different than elliptic curves and SHA-256, you know. So like shoving that stuff into Bitcoin while the car's driving down the street, like switching out the carburetor for a fuel injector, is like, maybe we shouldn't do this. And so that innate conservatism that's in the Bitcoin core developers is, I think, a real asset to the protocol. So when I talk about Bitcoin not being private enough, I hope people don't think that I'm unjustly criticizing Bitcoin. I think it's just long term. All of these projects, Ethereum, Bitcoin, any of the very public blockchains, will ultimately need to find ways to obscure that transaction graph, because otherwise we're going to just be basically giving totalitarian states the best tool for mass surveillance that man has ever developed. So with that in mind, we said, okay, what are the policy issues here? And the big ones are, of course, anti-money laundering law. So it's true. If you really have fully censorship resistant and privacy preserving cryptocurrency, of course it could be used and abused by criminals, just like any purpose agnostic tool could be used and abused by criminals. Like bank robbers use getaway cars. Even terrorists use encrypted messaging. This is just a reality, but that you know, I'm probably preaching to the choir with respect to your audience, but that doesn't mean we should ban automobiles and encryption, because most people using those tools are doing nothing wrong. Indeed, if they didn't have those tools, we'd be in a very poor society from a standpoint of just being able to do the things that people should be able to do in the world, like not have all their private data compromised or not be able to drive to the store to get groceries, you know? Anyway, I'm being a little long-winded and I'm blaming that on the jet lag. So we said, all right, well, if there's going to be this fear about illicit use of private electronic cash, and we use the term electronic cash because it's really like cash then. You can send it from one person to another. No one is in between. It's censorship resistant and it doesn't leave a record like cash transactions in the real world don't leave a record. If there's going to be concerns about money laundering with electronic cash, what if we get some sort of overbearing, overzealous response from policymakers that says, like, we can't have these things anymore? Basically, the same things that people sometimes say about encryption. We have to ban encryption, or we have to have backdoors forced into encryption. And so if that happened in the anti-money laundering context, the way it would look is basically a law that says, if you are a developer or maybe somebody who sort of runs the underlying infrastructure, like mining and things like that, of a electronic cash privacy-preserving cryptocurrency, you need to either compromise the software that you're developing or running and have a backdoor for law enforcement, or if you refuse to comply with that requirement, you need to not publish and distribute that software or not run that software. And so what that boils down to, very much like in the encryption debates that happened in the 90s and 2000s, is a question fundamentally of constitutional rights. Now, the one that a lot of people have always jumped to, and we've written about, I wrote a very long paper about all the constitutional issues surrounding any attempt to ban privacy-preserving cryptocurrency. And Jerry wrote a long paper that's excellent and everyone should read, making the moral and ethical case why these technologies should be allowed to exist and in fact should be celebrated by liberal democracies. But so the constitutional laws issues that I wrote about, most people have written about First Amendment issues here. And so I won't really bore your audience with that, although there's some good stuff in the paper that I uncovered that I think is still a little innovative and new. And those arguments are just like, you know, if you're writing computer code, you're engaged in a form of creative expression. You're just writing in C++ or in Go or in whatever instead of French or English. It's still speech. Doesn't matter that it's code. And so you're like, any kind of restriction on your ability or your right to actually express yourself in that way and just distribute your expression through the internet is unconstitutional as a prior restraint on free expression, which means that law should face strict scrutiny review. And that means that usually laws restricting speech are unconstitutional. But the First Amendment arguments, as I said, have been made for a long time. What I don't think is a well enough explored area, and we do a lot of it in our paper, but there should be even more, are the Fourth Amendment issues. And the Fourth Amendment issues that we wrote about are, I think, quite interesting. And they boil down to this. The Fourth Amendment in the US, and there are equivalents in, say, the International Covenant on Civil Political Rights and things like that. So it's not just a US-focused argument. The Fourth Amendment says that you need a warrant if you're law enforcement and you want to search somebody. And so we generally don't like bulk searches, bulk collection of information, because you can't write a warrant that's specific to collect information from all Americans. And this is an important judicial check on the authority that law enforcement would otherwise have to just have unlimited surveillance of all the things that we do. And so what's interesting in the financial context for the Fourth Amendment is this. Banks have been reporting our entire transaction history to governments whenever they ask without a warrant since 1976, I think is when the Bank Secrecy Act was first passed. Might be 73. And why is that constitutional? Like, all your bank records go to the government if the government wants them with no warrant. So basically they can just ask for the records of every American and all the people they've ever paid through their bank. And the reason why that's constitutional is a case that goes back to the 1970s as well, where the Supreme Court said, it's okay, it's constitutional in this context because people willingly hand over those records to banks during the regular course of business. banks need to know the persons that people are asking them to pay. They need to know their name and where they are. And people know that they need to convey that information to get the bank to pay those people. And so you lose your reasonable expectation of privacy over that information because you're sharing it with a third party. And then the third party can go ahead and share that information with the government without violating your right to not be searched without a warrant because you already released it into the world for this legitimate business purpose that the bank's engaged in. What's interesting about that holding is in the context of somebody saying, if you're a developer of something like Zcash, you need to collect information about your users. You need to file suspicious activity reports to government. There's no reason for a developer to have all that private information about the users of their software. There's definitely a reason for a bank to have a bunch of information about the users of the bank. But somebody who writes software and publishes it on the internet, they have no idea who's going to actually use that software any more than Neal Stephenson knows the intimate details of everyone who reads his books. I mean, I'd like to think he knows a little bit about me, hopefully. Probably not. It's my dream. But like his books are read by millions of people. There's no way that he could know all of them and let alone report information about all of them to the government. And that would be Orwellian. And the same is true of open source software. And so from a constitutional law standpoint, you say, okay, the only reason why it's okay for banks to bulk collect, surveil their users and report that to government without a warrant is because they have a reasonable business purpose to collect that information. There's no reasonable business purpose for an open source software developer to collect information about the users of their software. It just doesn't make sense. And so a constitutional requirement, a legal requirement that they do so would be unconstitutional because it would be an overbroad search in contravention of the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement. That's the argument briefly stated, and I know I'm really going on at length here. But if it's interesting to your audience, I highly recommend you pick up our report. It's explained much more carefully, and you don't have to be a lawyer or have gone to law school to understand it. And I think it's going to be a key battle coming up because if we're definitely going to see at least some governments, I don't think the U.S. anytime soon, actually, but some governments looking askew at this technology and saying, well, we need to ban the people. The distribution of the open source software, or we need to tell people to develop that software differently, which again, I think is unconstitutional.
Yeah, I actually skimmed part of that report and I highly recommend it to everybody. Well, Peter, it was awesome having you on the podcast. You're a friend of the project and we'll definitely try to get you involved with our summit as well. You should at least be in the audience when Neal Stephenson is.
Thanks, Manib. I appreciate that. And so, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And so where can people find you?
So all our work at Coin Center is made public, all our advocacy materials. We've got a series of like backgrounders explaining the tech and briefly explaining an area of law, like what is money transmission licensing? And that's just 2,000 words written by somebody in plain English. And we've got our longer reports as well. And all of that's available at coincenter.org. We make it available as a resource to the public and to policymakers. And we rely on donations from people who are just excited about the technology and want to see good advocacy in DC. So if any of you want to support our mission, we would very much be grateful for any support.
Yes, and Blockstack is a supporter, and they've been extremely happy with our involvement with CoinCenter. They've been super helpful whenever we needed them. All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Manib. Have a good one.
This has been the Stacks Podcast. You can follow Peter Van Valkenburg on Twitter at Valkenburg. Manib is at Manib, and I'm at Zach Valenti. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating or review for the show wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about building decentralized apps, please visit blockstack.org. The music in this episode is by Andrew Apple Pie. Check out andrewapplepie.com for more. Until next time, thank you for listening.